Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
You know, we've got a really good show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Amy Rule, a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, about how to create a successful partnership between providers and parents of children with rare diseases. It's interesting because rare diseases by their nature are rare, but a provider in practice will have patients with rare diseases.
Absolutely, and navigating that relationship with those families is challenging.
Yeah, so we'll probably get some tips that will help us and I'm sure help our listeners. I'm looking forward to that. First, we have some research that matters. Let's talk about our very first research, which is a smart thermometer. Well, that sounds good, right? I want thermometers to be smart. Like, I'd like them to tell me if I have a temperature before I even take my temperature.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. So this appeared in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases out of the University of Iowa. This was essentially looking at real-time data from smart thermometers that can track and predict influenza activity at national and regional levels.
One of the ways we know really about influenza tracking across the country, two different ways. One is when people get cases or we do testing for it. We have testing centers all across the country and we see upticks. One of the ways we know about it even sooner is the Google search term. When people start Googling, looking for influenza, that usually signals widespread outbreaks and we see that going up. So we have different ways of kind of tracking upticks. This sounds like another potential way.
Yeah, this was interesting. This looked and followed participants from late, you know, August 2015 to December of 2017. They had over 8 million temperature readings generated by almost 450,000 unique devices. And what they kind of were able to show is that this approach that they took was able to predict influenza activity at least 3 weeks in advance.
Interesting. 3 weeks before perhaps the curves have. Now, is it it might say when a community is going to have an influenza outbreak, and that could be useful. I don't know.
I think one of the more useful things from this, Adam, was actually that the smartphone data was able to kind of follow the fever curves in patients and were able to show that most fevers occurring during the flu season actually lasted 3 to 6 days and were much less likely to last only 1 day. So I think there is some patient education information within this to sort of at least tell people that, hey, you might have a fever for a few days. What I think they interestingly were able to show is that if there was a biphasic or initially a fever that went away and that came back, that this was predictive of more bad outcomes, more likely to suspect a bacterial pneumonia or a more serious illness.
Yeah, I have a little bit of cynicism here, Michael, only because, first off, this research was sponsored by the makers of this app. And second, I worry that data that is being used for a proprietary purpose, even though this was de-identified, I suspect when it's real time, it may not be. And then all of a sudden, I have a feeling that I'm going to see when data is fed in a advertisement for a drug coming to me over the phone. Now, that's just me, maybe a little of my cynicism, but interesting research, not yet certain it's really ready for prime time.
Yeah, nope.
Talk about prime time research. This next one is ready. It's being done. It's good.
This is good stuff here. So
really good. What are we talking about?
We're talking about, and you may know this well at home, but the impact of companion animals that they have on their owners. Do you have any animals in your home?
We have two incredible Khotans, little small dogs. And when I come home in the afternoon, my heart sings because they're always happy to see me, unlike some other people in my house who may or may not be happy.
I would love to hear your heart sing, but this came out of the BMC, British Medical Journal of Psychiatry. And what they were able to do is they looked and reviewed 17 international research papers. And this isn't, you know, a big shocker, Adam, for me, but they were able to show that these animal companion relationships intensified connectivity among people and that certainly that there were some improvements in, you know, mental health conditions as well, such as anxiety and depression.
Yeah, particularly in times of crisis. And I think, you know, this is being a systematic review. It puts this data together. And I think increasingly we understand the value and the importance of relationships with animals. I have a patient recently who had a bird for four decades, you know, a companion animal, been there since they were married. And when you have a loss, which is one of the downsides mm-hmm. of companion animals, it could be a profound loss. But the relationship is such an important healing part of helping them and helping all of us with our day-to-day living.
We should really be asking our patients about their human friends and maybe non-human friends that are in the home. Really, exactly like you said, looking out for potentially those more negative aspects of pet ownership, you know, the emotional loss, the burden, and helping to prepare our patients for those things.
Our next research that matters has to do with those bug bombs, those things that you put off to try to kill all the bugs within a certain radius, and a lot of times are used indoors to try to kill indoor bugs that may be infestation, which I can understand why you'd want to do it, but there's a problem here.
Yeah, these quote-unquote bug bombs or total release foggers, researchers found that there were over 3,200 incidents in over an eight-year period. And some of these illnesses included, you know, involving the respiratory tract, heart problems, neurological problems, eye problems. And so per the CDC's National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, apparently there were revisions on product labeling and instructions back in 2012, but it's unclear if these really instructions are being followed on a regular basis.
Now, do you look at the instructions for every product you use?
Do you?
Well, I think we like, oh, push the button yeah. here.
As long as it doesn't have the crossed skull bones on
push here and then run. But the problem here is that a lot of people were pushing these and using them in indoor spaces while they were still there. They were coming back within 2 hours and not being ventilated. So the inhalation of these insecticide foggers into their lungs and causing really a lot of problems, including some in young children, some in older patients. So these are hazardous types of products, in addition to which they don't necessarily cure some things that people would be using for, like cockroaches. They may not be effective on that. You know what I found that one of the most effective things for cockroaches?
What'd you do?
Completely clear the house of food and go on vacation for 2 weeks.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. I've also seen, like, we came in a situation a couple months ago where there were fruit flies, tens of thousands of them in a dwelling. And we did the old-fashioned way. We put some vinegar with tin foil, and three or four of those came back a day or two later. And guess what? All the fruit flies were in the vinegar.
A little bit more of a natural remedy. And what I'll say, you know, before we close on this is that, you know, this involved 10 states, some limited data. There were, you know, a number of what were considered false positives and had – all of this data had come about 3 years after the Environmental Protection Agency had enforced its new label requirements. But one of the authors said that it's even difficult for me to follow the instructions, which does not give me a lot of hope for maybe others out there who aren't even glancing at the instructions.
Our last research that matters is about the blood sodium level. And we talk on the show at various times about what can cause a low blood sodium or high blood sodium. We talk at times about some of the blood pressure medicines, a common medicine called like a diuretic that can lower blood sodium. But I don't think we've ever talked about blood sodium in cognition among older adults.
This came out of the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. And what researchers looked at out of the main researcher from University of Colorado was they looked at 5,000 asymptomatic community-dwelling aged men over 65. And they followed them for 5 years. And a total of 100 of those men had blood levels that were consistent with low sodium. And they found that compared with men with, you know, higher normal sodium levels, that they were 30% more likely to have cognitive impairment at baseline and 37% more likely to experience cognitive decline over time.
And this does not say what is cause and what is effect. So whether the sodium was causing cognitive decline or was an effect, an early marker of cognitive decline. But just like hearing loss can be a marker of cognitive decline, and you have hearing loss, it may actually get worse. This could also be a marker. I think it gives us a little bit more cause to really think about why the sodium is abnormal and that the normal range is normal for a good reason.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is a great, you know, kind of commentary into this bigger idea of deprescribing. So we have patients who are on numerous medications that can actually lower sodium levels. And so this may be a sign that it may be time to either lower those doses of those medicines or get rid of them because, you know, affecting cognitive impairment may lead someone to have more falls, getting lost, accidents at home can be really problematic.
You mean less medicine could in some cases be better?
It is possible.
Oh, my goodness. Good words. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Amy Rule, a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, about how to create a successful partnership between providers and patients of children with rare diseases. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Today on Conversations, Michael, we're talking with Dr. Amy Rule, a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, about how to create successful partnerships between providers and parents of children with rare diseases.
Welcome, Dr. Rule, to the show. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Michael and Adam.
Before we get into some of your writing, Adam and I, you know, understand that you are spent some time in North Carolina, and we really love to hear more about yourself and your family.
Sure. So I'm a Navy brat, so I kind of spent my childhood moving around both the East and West Coast. And my dad got out of the Navy and settled in Southern Virginia about 18 months before I went away to college, and I went to Wake Forest, and I stayed there for medical school. Little did I know at the time, I met an acquaintance who would later, like me, end up for some postgraduate training. I went for my pediatric residency, and then my husband, to be, was an academic speech pathologist. We ended up reconnecting in Cincinnati while I was in residency, and we got married. And about 8 weeks after we got married, we spent a year living in East Africa together while we did research in our respective fields and worked clinically. And then about 18 months after that, we welcomed our first child. His name is Oliver, and he'll be 18 months old next week. And I'm a pediatric and neonatal hospitalist, which is fancy doctor speak for I am an inpatient, so in-hospital pediatrician. I take care of kids that get admitted for pneumonia or skin infections or many other things. And then I also work in the newborn nursery and in the low-level NICUs.
Well, I must say, first off, you gave your son an amazing name, because that's my middle name, Oliver. And I feel this special kinship already. And I think the story and narrative is remarkable already, but our listeners will hear, I know, some more remarkable things soon, one of which is you just finished rounding at the hospital. Let me ask a question. Thus far, again, this is remarkable because you're rounding, you're a young mother, you're traveling, you're doing the sorts of things that make us proud to see in our colleagues. But you also have some other burdens, we might say. You yourself have written about that you had a chronic medical condition growing up that made you much more aware and sensitive to a disability, and then you also have a child that makes you much more aware of this.
Yeah.
That is something that gives you some really, really unique insights over and above what you've already described.
Yeah, so I was born with a really rare skeletal dysplasia. Skeletal dysplasia is just a bone condition. In our case, we have a variant in the recipe that makes collagen 2. So collagen 2 is like what gives the cartilage that's in our joints its durability. It's what allows the cartilage to sort of absorb all of those biomechanical forces of like daily life. And so in our case, our cartilage is not as strong because the yarn that makes up that cartilage is not quite as durable. And so we can develop osteoarthritis at a young age. And then in many people's cases, not in mine and Oliver's, many people are shorter than average, so they're little people. So many skeletal dysplasias are also types of dwarfism. Our particular one has a lot of variation in height, and I'm actually average height, and we think Oliver is going to be on the short side of average for a guy. But yeah, so I had probably 10, 15 different orthopedic procedures because cartilage is also in the growth plates. We grew, but our bones grew curved. And so I had multiple procedures that corrected those curvatures that allowed me to have the most mobility that I could. And then I had a hip replacement, one on one side in medical school and then the other one done in residency. And that actually was a big life changer. I went from pretty much using a manual wheelchair to round and do my activities of daily living that happened outside of my house in a manual wheelchair to being able to pretty much walk anywhere that's less than a mile to a mile and a half. So that was really exciting, and that's part of how I was able to live overseas and do some of the other cool things that I've done in the last decade. So yeah, there's no doubt that having a collagen 2 disorder influenced my choice in choosing medicine. My dad was a military physician, and I read his entire manual of orthopedic surgery when I was 10, trying to understand my own life, and I got so interested in medicine after that experience that I was pretty sure that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And so I became a pediatrician. And, you know, I thought for a long time that I would do something that was more directly related to children with disabilities. So either be a developmental pediatrician or maybe a peds rehab doc. But I found as I got through my training, I really just loved general pediatrics. And I had all these other interests and things that I enjoyed doing that weren't necessarily directly related to kids with disabilities. But I still, even before my son was born, you know, being an advocate for those kids is really important to me, and it's a really important part of my sort of vocation as a physician. And then, of course, after Oliver was born, so we knew there was a 50-50 chance, and that was something that we felt comfortable with. You know, the skeletal dysplasia and the little people community, we're a little bit like the deaf community. We see our conditions as something that does make our life more challenging, but that also makes our lives more beautiful in other ways. And so we were comfortable with the idea that Oliver might inherit. The surprise is that prenatally we were told he probably didn't. And then we found out, in fact, that he did. And I actually was the one that identified it in the delivery room. And so a lot of our challenges and what I wrote about in the JAMA article actually go back to us just trying to seek sort of basic preventative subspecialty care for a child with skeletal dysplasia. And we ran into some really interesting roadblocks.
You talk about, you know, it sounds like being, number one, an advocate for yourself over the years and managing, you know, your own health conditions and then kind of transitioning to, you know, a pediatrician and a pediatrician who is a parent in that JAMA article that you mentioned, which it was entitled, I Am That Parent. Why did you feel the need to write this, you know, very personal article, and why was that important to you?
So, you know, it's funny. My husband and I had made this commitment, actually, that we were not going to share a lot of Oliver's private health information to the wider world until he was at an age where he could be a part of that. And really, we really want him to be able to own his own story. But after this series of really negative experiences that I actually wrote about in my journal, which is actually where this essay originated from, with my own sort of private journal, we really felt like, as health professionals ourselves, if we're having this much trouble, and it was as traumatizing as it was, and we have two health professional parents, 30 years of experience of living with the same thing, and our child wasn't actually that ill. He wasn't in the ICU. He didn't need emergency surgery. And we were still having all this trouble really being able to access good quality care and having a good quality medical team. How hard is it for everybody that doesn't have all those resources? And so we kind of broke our vow a little bit and decided this is a personal story that we need to share, you know, for the sake of Oliver, for the sake of all these other families out there that we know are probably having the same struggle. And then I also, you know, as a provider and as a provider who is taking care of kids with medical complexity, I've had these tense and sort of awkward and painful encounters with families where things just don't go well. And I just feel like we have really difference of opinions, or we just feel like we can't see eye to eye. And I'm very empathetic to the providers that were involved in our care, both the positive and the negative experiences. It can be really hard to take care of something that you're not familiar with. And so, you know, I wanted to share this with all of my colleagues, too, so that we could have a conversation and hopefully a discussion like we're having now of how can we do a better job on both sides, and how can we learn to be able to understand a little bit what it's like for the person on the other side of the table.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're actually going to continue this conversation that we're having, talking with really a remarkable pediatrician and family, Dr. Amy Rule from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, about how we can all create better partnerships between providers and parents of children with rare diseases. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with your help with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Amy Rule, a pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, about how to create better partnerships between providers and parents of children with rare diseases. And right before the break, Dr. Rule, you really laid out a remarkable story of how you in your own health and dealing with the health issues that you had and the surgeries, but becoming a physician and a pediatrician and really wanting to care for others, and then during pregnancy and finding out ultimately that you have a child also that is facing difficult issues ahead, and yet you have chosen to write a remarkable article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's actually the most read article across the world. It's called A Piece of My Mind, and you wrote, I Am That Parent. And you told us a little bit about kind of how you were writing this article and why. Let's break it down a little bit more. What were you hoping to do by sharing this article for other parents out there?
Sure. Well, first of all, when I was writing this article, I didn't know I was writing this article. I was writing in my diary. I was writing in my journal on my laptop right after sort of the happy ending to the story, which is that we have an amazing medical team, and it was right after we had taken our second visit there. I kind of reflected back on what the last 13 months of Oliver's life had been and how it had changed me as a physician. I think as to what I wanted other parents to know by reading this article, I wanted to know that I heard them, and that I heard them in a way that I had never heard before. You know, even though I had grown up as a patient, I had never had that added layer of being a parent. And I think it is different. I think the medical decision-making is different. I think the stress is different than when you're the chronic patient. And I wanted also to apologize, even though I'm not sure any of my families that I have in mind, I don't know if they read JAMA, and I don't know if they're going to read this article, but I wanted them to know, hey, I don't think that I handled every one of these encounters the way that I wish I had. I talk about at the end of the piece this amazing mom who I worked with her child that had considerable medical complexity and ended up having a very rare, very mysterious diagnosis. And I actually got to meet her, and she heard our story, and I kind of heard her story again when we were on this panel for genetic counseling students. And that was, it really was a life-changing moment for me. And so I wanted to share that with other parents and say, hey, here is a doctor and a parent who maybe the encounter didn't always go perfectly, but when they were able to see where the other one was coming from, it really changed things.
Prior to the break, you had mentioned some of the more difficult experiences being a parent and sort of looking over the table, looking at the provider who was caring for your son, and reading this JAMA article. You apologize as a provider in some instances. What have you learned through your experiences as a pediatrician and now a parent? And also, as just a parent, what things can, you know, Adam, myself, other providers in these situations where there is, you know, maybe complex care or even just generalized care, how can we do a better job in facilitating better discussions and making individuals feel included?
I think that's a lot of questions in one, but I'll try to break it down. I mean, I think as to what I've learned, I think there's a lot to be said to just listen to someone's story. I often like to think that people with rare diseases, although it probably doesn't have to be rare, it probably just has to be chronic. I think that they come into our exam rooms or into our, you know, inpatient room with two histories. They have their medical history, which might be novel length and complicated, but they also have their history of their experience with providers. And I think being aware of those two histories, I think it can really help us as providers to be more compassionate, be more empathetic, and to listen before we speak. And I think also being mindful of those two histories, you know, I mean, even before I had Oliver, I definitely had had a myriad of experiences with medical providers. Some were great and some were terrible. And I think that acknowledging that that's probably true for a lot of people with rare and chronic diseases, and sometimes, especially if you're like the second opinion, which is always hard to be that person, and if the parents start to imply, you know, we didn't have the best experience or you really were frustrated with this, I think it can be really meaningful to say the words, wow, I'm sorry that your experience was less than ideal. You don't have to throw the other providers under the bus. You don't have to go into painstaking detail about why it was bad. You can just acknowledge that that happened. And I think that that can be really positive, because I think the thing is once somebody's trust has been violated, their trust has been violated. And so even just acknowledging that, I think, can really help build a relationship. And then I think that the other thing that is just so important, especially in the case of rare things where your knowledge as a provider is probably not going to be as much as you wish it was because you just haven't seen it before, and there's a lot to know in medicine, and the disease that you're going to see once in your career is probably not what you're spending your extra continuing education reading. And so in those situations, I think asking the patient and asking their family for resources or advice, or if there's a particular provider that is kind of the expert on them or the expert on this condition, I think that that can be amazing. I think it's going to improve the quality of care, and I think it's going to make the family more at ease. We have a wonderful provider that's a great example of this, Oliver's ophthalmologist. She told us the very first time she saw Oliver, she's like, you know, I've never seen anyone with this condition. I've seen someone with several of the more common related ones. Do you have any suggestions of articles or people that I could talk to? And I just found that so wonderful, especially as a physician parent, but just in general as a parent. You know, I think as doctors, we're afraid to say the words, I don't know. And sometimes that can actually be incredibly liberating in the land of rare disease, because guess what? The family may not know either, and you can figure it out together.
You know, I'm thinking back on people making assumptions, and you're kind of putting some of these assumptions to lay. And I suspect you've had to deal with some assumptions throughout your life, and yet you seem to have an ability to seek out and contribute. And when you went to Africa, what was that like, going to a place that people might make some assumptions about that experience? What was it like?
So, ironically, East Africa, in some ways, I found, compared to some contexts in North America, was more accepting. I don't know. I think some of it is for better or for worse. I think that, you know, disability is a part of a lot of lives there for a lot of reasons, whether it be poor health infrastructure or poor road infrastructure. There's a lot of trauma. And so I actually, I don't know, I didn't really experience a lot of discrimination or a lot of people treating me differently. I do think, though, if we were going to go more in depth about this, it's really a whole podcast in itself. You know, there's a lot of, in former colonial British Africa, I think that there's a lot of advantages and privileges and assumptions made about me because of the color of my skin. And so I think that people often saw that before they saw the disability. Now, when I didn't talk about this earlier, but when I was an undergrad in medical school, I spent some time in Eastern Europe, primarily in Romania, and that's a whole different game. Definitely had people ask me if I had escaped from an institution, and people were utterly shocked that my delinquent parents would allow their disabled child out of the house, much less out of the country. So that was quite an interesting experience. I had a host family that I lived with one summer, and literally that host grandmother really to think that my parents were like abusive and neglectful for letting their 19-year-old daughter travel overseas because I had a disability. And in that culture, it was very shameful. But that actually is not as true in East Africa. Wow. My husband and I actually were part of, well, we really were the cheerleaders for, I don't want to say that we founded it, but we helped a Kenyan physical therapist start an early intervention nonprofit in the rural area where we lived. And it was such a privilege to see someone who is, you know, from that local area and is committed to that local area and has all of that, like, relational capital that I'll never have as a white North American there, be passionate about caring for people with disabilities in his community. So in some ways, it's given me a lot of platform to be able to travel and to have connections with people. Like, there's a lot of sort of cultural gap between the two worlds, but I have this like shared life experience sometimes with others that has allowed me to have some really awesome experiences and conversations.
Wow, your global health story and those experiences in different parts of the world seem somewhat contrasted. Before we wrap things up here regarding, you know, your experiences, you know, in your own life, with your family, the article that you just wrote, are there any other final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
I think the only other thing that I really would like to say is that, you know, I've had an incredible response from this JAMA article. It's crazy, actually. I had no idea what I was doing in the sense of publishing this in terms of the amount of feedback and the number of people that have shared their stories with me. And I do think that it's really important to acknowledge something, which is that for Oliver and I, getting a diagnosis was really quite simple. And I guess I should say for Oliver, my own life story is a little bit different. But I think for a lot of rare disease families out there, especially in the pediatric world, getting that diagnosis can be a really long and really painful journey and very, very, very stressful for families. And I think there's sometimes this idea of like, why do you need a diagnosis? You know, like we're going to probably manage a lot of the symptoms the same way. But the diagnosis, I think, gives families closure. I think it helps them understand some of the reasons why things are happening. I think it also sometimes can tie them into incredible support communities of other families that are having similar experiences. And it may be able to tie them to providers and health systems that may be able to even provide more comprehensive management. And so that's not something that I can totally relate to, but I want to acknowledge it because a lot of the emails and a lot of the responses that I have gotten have talked about that diagnosis journey. So I think that's something else that I want people to think about, especially on the provider side. And then I think the last thing, and this is going to sound a little trite, but, you know, I think a lot of medicine, we tend to think of it as a series of protocols or a series of, you know, like sort of trial and error, a series of research projects, getting through your list. And I think that medicine really is a series of relationships. And I think how we treat those people that we come in contact with really does matter. There's going to be a lot of times where we don't have all the answers and where we don't have a cure or we don't have the perfect treatment plan or we don't fully know what's going on. But I think that we can always, no matter what the encounter is, offer people compassion and a listening ear and try to understand where they're coming from.
Well, I know that on behalf of your health, we feel grateful that you've shared your compassion and your experiences and your life with our listeners today. That's really a privilege. We're going to put up a link to your article, I Am That Parent, on our site so that our listeners can look at it. And have a wonderful day, and thanks so much for being with Your Health.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Michael Baca Atlas. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like for us to address on the upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth, no spaces or periods, at unc.edu. We'd like to ask our excellent executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I have eczema on my hands, but I also work in the food industry, and so I have to frequently wash my hands, which then further aggravates my condition. Do you have any suggestions?
So I've personally experienced this working in the food industry back in the day. I worked at a small cafe inside of a gym in the state of Maryland, and this is very common among food service workers and can be eczema is certainly common, but things like a contact dermatitis or even an irritant dermatitis from that repetitive hand washing or even some of those cleaning products. So I think protection is key. So protective equipment in these environments and making sure that the hands don't stay soaked for too long of time. And what I would say is if those basic interventions, so like I said, trying to avoid keeping your hands damp for a long time, changing out gloves so they don't get soaked on your hands. If those things aren't working, then it's probably a good idea to see a physician or another healthcare provider in your local area to sort of address, is this something different than the norm?
Yeah, I would imagine it probably is even worse during cold weather winter time. Is that a correct assumption?
Or? Absolutely. So eczema specifically, which we know is associated with things like asthma and seasonal allergies, the winter time is especially difficult because it's breaking down that skin barrier. And so anything on top of that essentially kind of cold climate on those hands is essentially going to make things worse. For people specifically with eczema, the most important thing is making sure that the skin barrier is well hydrated. One of the best ways to do that is with moisturizers, and there are a number of different products on the market that you can get out there from a number of different places. And what can happen then sometimes is your doctor may prescribe what's called a topical steroid onto the skin, especially in times where the skin is starting to get dry and flaky and someone might be having a flare-up of their symptoms. So typically the major mainstay of therapy is really just keeping that skin moisturized. On to the next question.
My brother was just diagnosed with bipolar disorder. What should I expect as he seeks treatment, and how can I be supportive?
So this is a really great question. Specifically, when we talk about bipolar disorder, there are varying severity of bipolar disorder. And so, again, bipolar disorder sort of implies that an individual may have depressive episodes or depressed symptoms along with more hypomanic or manic sort of overactive symptoms. And so essentially when someone starts treatment, that can look like a number of different things, as mild as just getting counseling and therapy. Typically, bipolar disorder does require pharmacotherapy or medications to try and limit the number of manic episodes or those other. It's a little bit harder to control those depressed symptoms, but I think a combination of medications, therapy, and really good contact with a psychiatrist and a primary doctor is key.
What a good sibling to be watching out and trying to help and be supportive.
Absolutely. What's our next house call?
I had an ectopic pregnancy a few years ago, and now my husband and I are trying again for kids. What are the chances of having to go through that a second time? Does it affect the likelihood of me having a healthy pregnancy?
This is a really good question. So the overall incidence of ectopic pregnancy is really not known, but we have some studies out there that suggest maybe the rate may be 20 per 1,000 pregnancies. But specifically, one of the largest risk factors for having an ectopic pregnancy is a prior ectopic pregnancy.
Oh,
and so one of the reasons, Laura, why that is the case is that if a person had an ectopic pregnancy in the past, sometimes they'll have surgery on the fallopian tubes, which carries the egg down to the uterus. And this can leave scarring and can essentially then cause problems moving forward and creating the possibility of another ectopic pregnancy. And I think that it would be really important, you know, with this history of having an ectopic pregnancy, that there's really good close follow-up and prenatal counseling when, you know, this family is interested in maybe having another person added to the family.
So they're right to be at least aware of the challenges.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's really great insight into their, you know, knowledge of what a history of an ectopic pregnancy may mean for the future. And that does not mean that they are not capable of having a normal intrauterine pregnancy or pregnancy inside the uterus. But per some studies and data that's out there, their risk is increased by about 3 to 8 fold. So definitely something to pay attention to.
Okay. So our last house call is, ever since I was a teenager, I've seen the same doctor as my parents and the rest of my family. Now that I'm an adult, I feel like I want to see someone different. How would you recommend I handle the search for a new provider?
This is something that comes up a lot is, you know, you maybe have been seeing a doctor in the same office with your family for a while, and maybe you're kind of ready to just separate your care from that practice. And it may not be because even you're not pleased with the service that's provided. You just want a little bit more personal and private space, which I think is pretty common. What do you think?
Well, I agree. I think that the interesting thing about this is when you've seen the same doctor since you were a kid, that choice has been made for you, in essence. And you could be perfectly pleased with the care that you've received, but maybe you just want to make your own choice about your health care. And I think that that makes a lot of sense.
And I think any provider that's out there, in my opinion, would want the best for the patient, the individual. And so I would never take it personally if someone decided to transfer their care elsewhere for their own comfort. I think people get the best care when they're feeling like they can trust the person sitting across from them and feel like they can open up. And that's the best way to really, you know, minimize issues between, you know, the provider and the patient.
Great.
Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we have addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Please share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealth.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and Our Health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Amy Rule. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Michael Baca-Atlas. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.